Hey campers, KJ here. I think about Gretchen Rubin's four tendencies rubric frequently. My personal label, which I sometimes resist because, of course I do, is rebel. It's hard for me to do anything expected or demanded, and the best way to get me to do anything, even things I want to do, is for me to believe that other people think I can't do it. The more impossible, the more rigor I bring to the task. Understanding that about myself has helped me in more ways than I could list here. We dug into so much in the interview I'm about to share with you, but in particular, we were chasing after anything and everything that would help us and you sit down and get the work done. I promise it delivers, which is why I've brought it out to share again. If you heard it the first time, you might get even more out of it now that some time has passed. And if you didn't, stick with us for something good. But first, are you ready to finally finish that book draft or revision? Are you itching to learn new tools or frameworks to make the writing process easier? Are you looking for a side gig to add to your repertoire? Author Accelerator's Book Coach Certification Program is a robust and exciting way to learn new writing and publishing skills. Their certification course in fiction or nonfiction includes hundreds of hours of video lessons, workshops, and practice exercises, all about researching the marketplace, querying agents, project management for your book idea, and more. They're great, and I say that as someone who's done this. Many writers come to the program looking to up their writing game. Writer and certified book coach Trevor Brooks says, "This course changed my life. I feel more confident than ever in my ability to develop a manuscript as both a writer and a coach that will attract the attention of an agent and a publisher." So, if you're ready to try something new and join a community of writers and book coaches helping writers, visit authoraccelerator.com/writing to learn more. Oh, one more thing. If you're not signed up to get our emails, you should be. Last week, email subscribers got links to 3 pop-up write-alongs with me, KJ, and there are more coming, along with thoughts on revision, TikTok, and more. Pop your name on the list at amwritingpodcast.com.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause and...
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia.
And I'm Jess Leahy.
And... this is hashtag AmWriting
with Jess and KJ.
Thanks for listening. Hashtag AmWriting is, as you might or might not know, our podcast about all things writing. Writing long pieces, short pieces, books, proposals, but most of all, it is the podcast about sitting down and getting the work done.
And I am Jess Leahy, and I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and a bunch of other stuff that you can find if you Google me.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm just going with
the
short intro.
We're anxious to get to it today, yeah. And you guys will see why in a minute. I am KJ Dell'Antonia. I am the author of the forthcoming How to Be a Happier Parent and was the editor of the Motherload blog at the New York Times for many, many years. You can find me by going to followkj.com.
Which is brilliant, but my new tagline is, just Google me.
Okay, fine. That's classy. All right, we are excited today because we have a guest who is really going to help us dig down into our favorite topic, how to sit down and get the work done. Welcome, Gretchen Rubin.
Hey, I'm so happy to be talking to you both today.
Thank you so much for coming. This is great. And we asked Gretchen here to talk to all of us about her book, The Four Tendencies, which is a book about how we react to expectations and who we are in that respect.
And we love Gretchen because she likes to break things down for people and analyze how people do stuff and why. So Gretchen, tell us about the four tendencies.
Yeah, and the four tendencies, it's this personality framework that I came up with, and it has a lot of implications for getting writing done. So I'm super excited to be talking about it with you guys. So as you mentioned, it has to do with how we respond to expectations. And we all face two kinds of expectations. Outer expectations, like I need to write this report for work because my boss is waiting for it. And then we have inner expectations, like our own desire to do something for ourselves. So I want to keep a New Year's resolution. I want to write a novel in my free time. And so depending on how you respond to outer and inner expectations, you're either an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel. Those are the four. And I'll give a brief overview of the four. There is a quiz you can take on my site at gretchenrubin.com. There's like a quick free quiz that like 1.3 million people have taken.
It's really fun to take.
It is
fun. Good. Oh, that's nice to hear. But like a lot of times people don't even need to take the quiz because they can just tell what they are from the description. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline. They keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. Then there are questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So they're making everything an inner expectation. If it meets their standard, if they think it's justified, they'll do it. If it fails their standard, they'll push back. And so they will typically rail against anything arbitrary, inefficient, irrational.
I have a child that does that on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, it can be very, very obvious. Then there are obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So this is the person who has no trouble getting something done for a boss or a coworker or a friend. But then when there is an inner expectation, something that they're just trying to do on their own or, you know, self-care or something that's a priority for them, but that doesn't matter to other people very much, then they struggle. And then there are rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They can do anything they want to do. They can do anything they choose to do. But if you ask or tell them to do something, they're very likely to resist. And often they don't like to tell themselves what to do. Like they don't want to sign up for a 10 a.m. class on Saturdays. They don't want to write a to-do list because they don't like this feeling that something or somebody is expecting them to do something or show up someplace. So those are the four. Obliger is the biggest tendency for both men and women. So that's the one the largest number of people by a fair amount belong to. And then rebel is the smallest.
I would be really, really curious to see what I was going to ask you about sort of, you know, which ones are the biggest ones and if they fall into certain categories of occupations. But I was thinking, as always, I'm always thinking about teachers and I'm always really curious, you know, what tendencies teachers have and then what tendencies they tend to teach to. Do they, you know, do we tend to teach toward, I know in terms of introvert and extrovert, I tend to teach towards the extroverts and I have to be very careful to make sure I'm doing things that honor the way introverts are more likely to behave in class. So did you find anything in terms of occupations?
Well, it's interesting. I think all occupations can do just about any profession from their own way. Like you can imagine an upholder loving to be a teacher. You can imagine a questioner loving to be a teacher. You can imagine an obliger loving to be a teacher. You can imagine a rebel loving to be a teacher. I think they could all do it, but I think they would bring their own spirit and their own perspective to it. And they would thrive better when they figured out a way to make it work with their tendency and kind of avoid some of the pitfalls that perhaps their tendency had. But I think you put your finger on something that's incredibly important in one way where I hope the tendencies can help people, which is that we all tend to do things in a way that makes sense for us. If you know the love languages, it's like you speak the love language that you understand. You know, if you're a questioner, you tend to relate to people as questioners because you just think, well, doesn't everybody want lots of reasons and justifications and like what could be more natural? But then when you understand the tendencies, you're like, well, you know what, actually, other people need different things to thrive. And so how do I reach this particular person in a more effective way? Or how do I create a situation where lots of different people can attach to it in their own, from their own perspectives? Instead of just thinking like, well, why is everybody not like me? They must be nuts.
That's the part that I find most interesting is how do you get at the kernel of what it is someone else needs to be able to work well with you? And I mentioned my kid and I've learned, you know, I learned fairly early on that if I say you have to do this because this is just the way it's done and you're going to have to grin and bear it, that does not go over very well with this particular child. But if it's his idea, he's all over it.
But so, and I'll give, and one of the, just to focus on questioners for a minute, that's the second largest category, by the way, after obligers, questioner. So there's lots of questioners in the world. It's very poignant to me hearing from many, many questioner adults who had major stumbling blocks in their childhood because somebody just really would not take literally 10 minutes and explain to them, why am I asking you to write this book report? You think it's a big waste of your time because I know you've read the book. Why am I asking you to write this book report? If you would give that child reasons, then they will understand. And somebody just like 2 weeks ago was saying how he played soccer. He loved playing soccer. He was the goalie. He loved being the goalie. But the coach made him do all the same sprints and everything that all the other players did. And he said to the coach, I don't understand why I'm doing the kinds of exercises that they're doing. I should do things that are specifically for a goalie. And the coach did not say something like, oh, well, I've studied the training techniques of the Olympic teams, and I'm here to tell you that this is why you're doing that. Or, oh, you might think you don't need a cardio workout, but in fact, it affects your reflex response rate or something like that. No, the coach said, I'm the coach, and I'll tell you what to do. And so the guy quit because he's like, I'm not going to do it. It's just stupid, and I'm not going to do it, and so I'm going to quit. And so he lost the chance to be on a team and to have a lot of fun and to do something he enjoyed because he's like, this is just so stupid and dumb and irrational and unjustified. I can't be part of it. Whereas if that coach had literally, I don't even know anything about sports and I could make up 50 things that would have been an appropriate response, you know? So
that's so great. Cause you know, so much of what I talk about when I talk to teachers is about helping kids see things as relevant to them, because that's where the best learning happens. You know, we learn the things that we care most about and feel are relevant to us. And so, you know, that's fantastic, but we should talk about what we actually want to talk about, which is, oh my gosh, what are writers? Let's talk about writers.
Well, yeah. I have a great question from a listener to start with. So I wanted to start by talking about how the tendencies affect writers who also have day jobs, who are both either part-time or full-time, in a set job and are also freelancing or working on their books. And here we go. This is one of our listeners, and she either, actually don't know if it was a he or she, said, I'm an obliger, and I'm trying to write my first book, a YA novel, but I work part-time, and I have kids, and it gets pushed off again and again. I feel like that's a really obvious problem, like that's everybody's problem, but, you know, how can I fix it?
Wait, did she say she was an obliger at the front, or did I imagine?
Yeah, no, and then it's pretty obvious, but yes, yeah, yeah. She said it up front, so this is, right. Yeah. And yet, yeah, so, it's gotta be a woman.
Yeah, yeah. So, the thing is, The answer for an obliger is always the same, because the primary frustration for obliger is that they meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet their own expectations. So there's no trouble doing things at work, but when trying to do something like write a YA novel in the free time is a struggle. And the fact about obligers is that they often feel very frustrated about this, but the solution is very simple and straightforward. So in a way, their problem is the easiest to solve of the three tendencies. Like, their weakness is the easiest to put in the fix. Which is outer accountability. It's like, you need outer accountability to write that. Don't say things like, I need to make it a priority. I need to take more time for myself. I need to learn to make time. None of that. Create outer accountability. So join a writing group where everyone is committed to writing a certain amount every month. And if you don't do it, you're going to be letting down the group. Pay for a writing coach who's going to help you set deadlines and stick to them and hold you accountable. Take a class where you have to hand in material, or, you know, the instructor is going to be evaluating you on whether you're actually turning in work. And another thing you could do, like if you have kids, a great thing is to use your kids as accountability partners. So you could say to your kids, hey, look, you know, you have your work that your teacher is giving you, and I have my work that I'm giving to myself because I want to do that. And so the thing is, when you're doing your work, I'm going to be doing my work. And by the way, kids, if I'm not doing my work, you don't have to do your work. And so they're going to police you, because they're like, hey, don't you think it'd be more fun to check Facebook? You know, because then they get off the hook. So there's a lot of ways to create accountability once you realize that that's what you need.
I am always offering that to my obliger kid. I'll say, okay, it's a weekend morning and I'm going to do X for, you know, I'm going to be sitting here from working for 2 hours. If you want to sit with me, you know, here I am. And here is this the cone of accountability. It often works for him.
That's what also what our little texting circle does for me. And I've talked about this a million times, but KJ and I have a little texting three-way with our friend Serena, who's an author. And we just text the word sticker to each other when we've reached our goal for the day. And just seeing that word sticker is incredibly powerful for all of us, I think.
And as a rebel, it makes me want to live up. No, it makes me go, oh, wait, I can do that. Hey,
right.
Hey,
right. Watch me.
I can do that. Yeah. You don't think I can get that sticker in the next... You know, before midnight, I can do that. Yeah.
But so that's the thing is it's like this, that's a great example of how simple and like painless that is. Like it does not take that much time to like have that accountability structure in place. It doesn't have to be a big burdensome thing. Sometimes obligers say to me like, well, I'm an introvert. I don't want to take a class. I don't want to have a trainer or a coach. It's like, fine. There's lots of ways to do it. The way you're describing it's, I mean, how much time it's de minimis amount of time and energy, but it's enough to create the accountability that gets you writing. And so a little bit, it does not need to be something that takes a lot of time, energy, or money. Accountability, it's just understanding that that's the button that needs to be pushed.
So let's talk about the other tendencies with respect, when you're trying to, like, I think there's a lot of people out there who are sort of trying to get to the point in writing where maybe they don't have to have a day job. So, right. So they're doing both. So if you're a questioner, what are some ways that you can, establish that writing habit around the rest of your life?
So the thing about questioners is for them, it's all about sort of efficiency and justification. And so what they really need to do is sit down and think like, okay, given everything that I need to do, given where I want to get in my life, like what is the most efficient, practical, reasoned way that I can set things up to work for me? Once questioners really have that inner clarity of why they're doing certain things the way they are, then it becomes much easier for them to follow through. So if you're a questioner and you're kind of stuck because you're like, well, I've got this day job, but I need to spend more time on my freelance work. But then, it's sort of like, I feel kind of paralyzed or stuck. It's like, really get clear, like sit down with the calendar and be like, okay, when am I going to do this? How much time? You might monitor how much writing you're doing. Questioners tend to love kind of to do self-hacking. Because they like to monitor and see where their time is going, where their energy is going. They tend to really like that kind of thing. And often just with anybody, with monitoring, if you know how much you're doing something, you tend to do a better job. Like if you know how much you're spending, you spend more wisely. If you know what you're eating, you eat more wisely. And so just say something like, okay, well, I'm really going to just like do a time log for a week. What am I doing for my day job? How much am I spending on my freelance? Where do I see the pockets where I could make a shift? How much time is my ideal? Really plot it out, because that's when questioners have clarity, that's when they can move forward more easily.
You know what I love about this is I'm seeing that the sticker, which is our, when you meet your goal, you get a sticker. This can work for every tendency.
Mm-hmm.
The obliger tells friends they have her getting a sticker. The questioner has established this goal. And so every time they meet it, they get a sticker. The rebel can get angry because people don't believe they can get a sticker. And for the upholder, I mean, everybody loves a sticker, right?
But it only works for most people if the sticker is something that is your own reward for the thing.
Well,
not if someone else is saying to you, you get a sticker if you clean the toilet. Because then, those rebels are like, well... Forget it. I don't need a sticker then.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, KJ, that the sticker works for you, because for you, it's like a challenge. Like, you think I can't do this? Watch me. I'll show you. And that's one way rebels respond. And that, in this circumstance, is like a very positive way, and it's working for you really well. Sometimes rebels get into trouble or they feel frustrated when they feel like you're checking up on me. The fact that you're checking up on me makes me want to resist. It inspires that feeling of resistance. But I think, to Jessica's point, it's sort of like, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm telling you what I did. So you can do what you do. You're free to do what you want to do. I'm telling you what I did. And so maybe it doesn't ignite that spirit of resistance, where if I feel like you're checking on me, a lot of times rebels don't like that feeling. They're like, I don't want you looking over my shoulder telling me what to do.
Well, and I don't always text the word sticker. Like, I get a sticker and I don't always tell people I got a sticker. This is my sticker. Plus, I am allowed, because it's me. I could do whatever I want, right? So yeah, I change the boundaries for my sticker change, on a very regular basis.
Yeah, lately my stickers have been for reading research, because I'm at the very beginning of a book project. But the thing that tends to make me sit up is that our friend Serena tends to text when she gets a sticker almost every day. And she is our most prolific. She's the most prolific person I know anywhere, I think. And so, the evidence is there. You look at the word sticker and you think of who's sending it to you, and you realize, oh my gosh, wow, it really works, because she's chugging out, a book every 3 months, and she's amazing and she does so well. And so, it's kind of like the evidence for it is right there. The evidence for why it's important is right there.
Right. Because it's a reminder, like, this is the kind of study work that's going to yield the outcomes that I like.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, it's interesting though to note, like for someone like I, because I'm an upholder, like one thing that some upholders say is like it's kind of a relief to realize that upholders tend not to need accountability. They might like it, like I might like to get the sticker, but they don't really need it. And sometimes you can save time and energy by not worrying about accountability. Like I used to keep these elaborate resolution charts when I was doing my happiness project experiment, and then I realized like I don't really need the charts, so I can save myself the time and the fuss of dealing with them because it's in my own head. And so again, sometimes the tendencies mean like, well, maybe somebody needs something, but I don't. So I don't need to worry about that. Or maybe I desperately do need something. So even though somebody else doesn't seem to need this, this is something that's worth my time and energy and effort to create because this is the kind of thing that's going to help keep me on track. Sometimes I think we look at other people who are models or we think, well, they're doing a really good job. I'll do what they do. And while it might work for you, but it might not because they might just be different in a way that's important in this situation so that something that we're, you know, like how many people say, oh, you got to do a to-do list, do a to-do list, do a to-do list. It's like the most important thing. Well, a lot of people, especially rebels, I don't know about you, KJ, they don't like to-do lists. The minute it's on a to-do list, they don't want to do it. So it's like, okay, well, how can you achieve the same aim but not use this tool that's not working for you? There's a lot of ways to get done what you want to get done, but if a certain tool doesn't work for you, don't say there's something wrong with you or that you need to change. Just be like, okay, well, what's another tool? This tool isn't working so well. There's lots of tools in the toolbox. Let me switch to something else and see if something else helps me achieve my aims better.
I was using one tool in a way that was, excuse me, getting me in a little bit of trouble. I know for a fact that I need deadlines. I need them. I'm an obliger. I need deadlines. And so for a while there, I was telling my editor or my agent or someone that I would get something to them by X. And the problem was the minute I did that, if something came up, then I blew a deadline with someone that it's really important that I don't piss off. So now what I've started doing is instead of doing that, I'll say to my husband before he leaves in the morning, I'll say, okay, here's what's happening today. By the time I get home this evening, I want to have sent, you know, X number of pages off to my editor, and that's my goal for the day. And he then will ask me about it at the end of the day. And I know he's going to ask me about it at the end of the day. So instead of sending it out into the world in such a way that, you know, you would think that sending it off to an editor would say, you know, oh, by the end of the day today, you're going to have 26 pages. The problem is that there's enough that can come up that I've learned that needs to be more of a private, but still have an accountability with someone that it's going
to
get done.
That just sounds like a short route to divorce to me.
No.
Oh, it's but good. Can I say why? Oh, but this is such a perfect example.
Isn't
okay.
It?
So, because to
I would
KJ,
kill. To I KJ, would kill my husband. If, in fact, I sometimes if he even just happens to know, and he comes home and he's like, "So did you do such and such?" And I'll be like, "No, what's it to you? Or, yeah, what's it to you?" it makes me. I actually hate for other people to know my goals.
Yes, because it ignites that spirit of resistance 100%. And this is why this advice that like tell people your goals and like share. I'm like, no, not necessarily. For some people that doesn't work. But see, so here's a perfect example. So for Jessica, that works really, really well for you. And your husband is being very helpful in that he's playing that role for you. He's remembering to ask. That takes work and effort on his part to play that accountability partner for you. Now, see, and in past, before I understood about the tendencies, so I'm an upholder. And one of the things that upholders will often feel or think is, I don't want to be your babysitter. I don't want to look over your shoulder. I want you to do your work in your way. I'm going to do my work in my way. And then we're all just going to get everything done. And like, what's the problem? It's like, that's why they can seem kind of cold and judgmental. But so, and a questioner similarly is like, why do I need to check up on you? If you want to do it, do it. If you want to get stuff done for your own reason. If you don't get it done, I don't need to hear about it. And so they're not playing that role for you, even though that's what you want and need. And so I think it's helpful for, and same with a rebel. It's helpful to realize, okay, I might not want my spouse to say, hey, did you get that done today? But this is what someone else needs. This is what they want. This is how I serve this relationship for them. Even if it's not the kind of thing that I would want, that's what somebody else wants. Because again, it's back to that earlier point about understanding that people have different perspectives. Something might set your own teeth on edge, but that doesn't mean that it wouldn't work for somebody else. And I've seen that all, because as an upholder, I'm often like, well, I don't want to give you a deadline because I don't want to put pressure on you. Just get it done when you can. That doesn't work for other people. They don't like that feeling of kind of unbounded, whatever. It's just like, then it never gets done. I've learned like, no, you have to speak in a way that is going to be more helpful for other people. So but that's fantastic, though, that you figured out how to tweak the idea of accountability so that it gives you the flexibility that you need professionally, but it's still keeping you on track.
Well, it's so funny because I've actually seen you do that because I know I've seen you say, I sent it because I said I would, but it wasn't really ready. And I love that you fixed it. I didn't even know.
Yeah. Well, and the other nice thing is that we've been married now for, we just had our anniversary. So it's, I think, 22 years now. And the nice thing is I know that if he asks me at the end of the day, I can just say, nope, didn't happen. And, you know, that absolutely does not change his feelings about me as a competent human being. He actually, it probably will lead to a very entertaining story about all the other things I did in avoidance to not do that thing. But then it also forces a conversation for me anyway about, so now when are you going to get that thing done? And it's not that he's checking up on me. It's just this lovely...
See, she made me itch just by saying, now when are you going to get that thing done?
I know. I felt her tense up next to me, so I decided to make it very clear. Because, you know, the nice thing about our marriage is that we do most of our job is so completely different from each other, but we both write. And so we have that sort of ability to talk to each other about our writing. And he knows that I'm going to get it done eventually. And I know that he knows that I'm going to get it done eventually. It's just, it's that a nice little role in our house.
See, it's so interesting. Now, I will note just for other obligers that sometimes sweethearts don't make good accountability partners for very romantic reasons. It's like, you're so close to me, you're like part of me, so I'm going to ignore you just the way I would ignore me, and your expectation doesn't help. But for you in this situation, it does help. But sometimes obligers get frustrated because the spouse of an obliger might be like, well, I keep reminding my husband to exercise, why doesn't he listen to me? But then the minute his doctor told him to exercise, he started. It's like, well, because you're so close, you kind of can count as inner. But that the difference between inner and outer with a romantic partner, it can be very fluid. It can change depending on what the expectations are. But it's great that in this circumstance, he's like your Jiminy Cricket. He's like, how, you know, did you do it today? That's great. See, that's helpful. But if somebody didn't, but you could have somebody else in your life, like the texting, you know, if you don't have a romantic partner, it's not like, okay, well then there's no accountability for me. It's like, oh no, there's a million ways to create outer accountability. This just happens to be like an ingenious way that you figured it out for yourself.
All right, so we have another question from a questioner. It says, I've Love taken this. The quiz and I'm a questioner. I am also a freelance writer. I used to work as an editor myself, but now I freelance full time. And it turns out I have a hard time working with editors. So often I feel like they assign me one thing and then they read it and they want something else. Or I do exactly what the assignment was and now they don't like it. So two things happen. I want to argue with them when that does happen. And I want to ask all these questions when I get an assignment so it doesn't happen. And I know, because I was an editor, that no one likes that. So but it's hard not to. What can I do?
Well, I think, guys, don't you agree, though, that this is something that everybody, no matter what their tendency, this is like a major problem with editors, is that doing freelance jobs, right?
Yes, it's editor's fault.
This happens all the time. Like, that's just right. I never do that kind of work myself, but just from friends I have that are writers, this is something that is just like super annoying that happens frequently, right?
Yes.
So, well, one thing is to say probably asking a lot of questions up front isn't going to solve this problem, because my sense is that a lot of times it's like, either on the editorial side, things are evolving, and so what they need is slightly different, totally apart from you, or they just really didn't know what they wanted until they saw it. And so asking a lot of questions up front probably would cost you more in reputational kind of relationship than it would gain you, because you could get them to commit to 15 things, and then they would still say, no, it's not
right,
what I
and
want.
Then you're just going to want to be like, but look at this email. This is what you said.
Yes, and then you've put all this time and effort into that exchange, which then is irrelevant. So that would probably just make you more angry. I think this is just kind of a problem of that role. But for a questioner, one thing that questioners that really should work on is, a lot of times people will see their questioning as an attack on authority or undermining of judgment or obstructionist. Why are you asking me all these questions? Why can't you just take my word for it? Why can't you accept my authority? And so one thing questioners need to do is to learn how to be constructive in their questioning. So instead of saying something like, I don't understand why I would include that part in the piece because that seems totally irrelevant to me, right? That's like, oh, you're attacking me as an editor and your questions are making me feel on the defensive. You might say something like, you know, I'm not 100%, I really want to make sure that I get what you want. And so like, explain to me a little bit more what you're looking for in this direction. So it's more like, give me the answers that I need to execute according to your will or like to what you're looking for rather than attacking what you're saying. But I do think that this is just a problem in the in that process, which is that and this is the kind of thing where you can see that for certain tendencies, it pushes their buttons differently. And for a questioner, it's like, this doesn't make sense. This is an efficient use of time. If I had done this earlier, I could have done it all in a much more reasonable way. That kind of wastefulness and lack of clarity and focus can be particularly annoying to questioner. Whereas like an obliger and upholder might be like, well, what are you going to do? The editor is the editor, you know, it's like, I get it. Their editor is probably, you know, the editor in chief is probably telling them something. Whereas to the questioner, it's just maddening. And so this is a thing where maybe it's not that you can't do that profession, but certain aspects of it might be more or less burdensome to you, depending on how they line up with your tendencies, core values.
Yeah, it's making it sound like being a freelancer is maybe a tough row for a questioner.
It's a tough row for everyone, I
well,
think.
Well, there is that.
But also it can be a wonderful thing for a questioner because Questioners tend to love investigation and research. And for them, it could be like, oh my gosh, you know, I've always wanted to learn more about synesthesia and now I'm going to get paid to do it. Like, because they like the research, they like pulling things together. They often like to teach. So you can see how it would be an ideal job for a questioner in some ways. But it's like, you know, every profession has parts that you like more or less. And some people are just going to have different views about what the best parts are and what the worst parts are.
So I had one last, because we're kind of coming to the end of our usual time slot, but I just wanted to tell you that I've been working on fiction, and I am finding the tendencies to be kind of a fun way to look at your characters. Have you talked to anybody else who's done that?
I have a little bit. My sister is a TV writer in Hollywood. You know, we have this podcast, Happier, and she's my co-host. And she's talked a little bit about how sometimes she'll think about it in terms of if you're building a character, thinking about like how they would respond in different things. And one of the things I love to do I have this app, the Better app, where people are all talking about the tendencies. And one thing I love is when people talk about TV characters or book characters or, who embody the tendency. So for instance, Hermione Granger is a very famous upholder. Yeah, classic upholder. George Bailey, if you've seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life, he's a classic rebel, 100% rebel. Jane Eyre, I think Jane Eyre is a questioner. Let me have an excuse to reread Jane Eyre for the 100th time and see and look at it from that lens. And literally, know her hateful aunt who's so mean to her. On the first page of the book, I mean, it is, you don't even turn the page. And her aunt says, Jane, I hate questioners.
Oh, that's funny.
Excellent.
Literally called a questioner on the first page of Jane Eyre. So I think it can be really helpful because like anything, any kind of personality framework that helps you build out seeing the contradictions or the patterns, I think that's when characters have the ring of truth to us, is when they reflect what we see in the world and the kind of combinations and the behaviors that we see in the world around us. That's when characters feel so fully realized.
What I think is so fun about the tendencies is that they are really so behavioral. So, you know, what you think you are is what you are. And you know, what you do shows what you are. It's not like it's some secret. It's not like you're saying, well, underneath I can see. It just sort of is, which I think is, when you can see them reflected in so many ways in fiction and in other places, it's like you say, it's a framework. I love that idea of it as a framework. I think that's why it's so much fun to talk about, is because it's not like a limit or a demand, or, you know, like a, well, you're this way, so you must always do things that way. It's just a framework.
Yeah, it's just a framework. But you're right. I mean, the thing that's funny to me is once you see them, they're not subtle. Like, I'm kind of amazed nobody's come up with this before, because you start seeing them all around you. It's like, this is not some deep, deep analysis that's, you know, reflection that's necessary. It's like right there on the surface. Like, you quickly see it. I mean, like even like when we hear from listeners from our podcast, it's like they will often say like their name and their tendency. It's like they know, you know, it's not a secret. Like,
it is hard obvious. In children, though. I've heard you talk about that before.
It can be. For some children, it can be very difficult. And then for some children, it's perfectly obvious. Like, for sometimes, it really manifests very, very early. And then you're right. But sometimes children aren't autonomous in the way that adults are. And so sometimes it's not so easy to tell.
Well, you want to talk books?
Yes, this was really fun. So at the end of every podcast, we like to, having done hashtag Am Writing, we like to switch our gears to hashtag Am Reading. So we ask you the question, have you read anything good lately?
Yes, well, I've read a lot of good stuff lately. So I have recently discovered the work of Nnedi Okorafor. And I got into her with Akata Witch, which is a book. It's like Harry Potter in Nigeria is how a friend described it to me. And I'm like, let me bust my way to the door of the library to get that book.
Wait, can you spell that?
I just bought it for my students, and it's going over huge in my classroom. It's The Akata Witch, A-K-A-T-A.
Okay.
Yes. And her name is Nnedi Okorafor. She also writes, she's written very acclaimed adult science fiction. So she's kind of in the fantasy science fiction space. But I'm just like working my way through all her books. I love it when you have a writer, when you're like, okay, I'm starting in one place and I'm just going to go through the whole list. So she has a trilogy called the Binti Trilogy, which is for adults. But I think a lot of probably YA readers would like it as well. So I love Nnedi Okorafor, and that's been like a whole treasure trove. And then kind of totally switching gears is a writer who used to be very, very, very well known, an English writer who's kind of forgotten now, but her name is Elizabeth Gouge. She wrote, she's most famous for a book called Green Dolphin Street, which was made into a movie, which I haven't seen. I just read a book by her called A Bird in the Tree, which is the beginning of a trilogy. But these are like, if you like an English book about sort of the people in the English countryside, like having their adventures and their dramas, it's like very much like that.
Is it Angela Thurkell-esque?
Yes.
I love Angela Thurkell. You may have just found me a new writer.
Yes. No, it's very, very, very much like that.
Awesome.
Very much like that. Now, I've just started getting into her, so I don't know. You know, some writers are very even and some are not even. And so I haven't read enough to her to know, like, is she even, or like, do you really have to be like very strategic about which ones you read and what, you know, whatever. But I'm really enjoying it. And she wrote a ton. So again, I'm like, ooh, am I at the beginning of a long road because I've liked what I've read so far.
Oh, I could use that. I've been throwing a lot of fiction aside lately. So
I've been throwing a lot of books aside, you know, 20 pages in and you're like, okay, this is not going the distance. I'm going to get out now.
That's right.
I actually just did that with a book that, a book that came out to huge publicity, to huge, you know, it's already a movie, blah, 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 blah. And I read it and I stuck it out because I thought, oh, it's just, but it's getting all this great press. I have to finish it because maybe it's going to redeem itself. And it never did. It just never did. And I was so sad.
Yeah, welcome to our worst characteristic as podcasters. Sometimes we vague. What would you even call that?
Vague pan
books. Because we don't like to be. It's hard to write a book, so we don't like to say bad things unless you're super, super famous. Then we will.
Yeah, I think one time I said something not nice about a Dan Brown book because we thought he could take it.
Yeah, his sales have not plummeted. So.
No, I mean, I think as a writer, you know how much love and energy and work and thought goes into even the worst book. And so I agree. I come to praise, like every week on Sunday on Facebook, I post Gretchen Rubin Reads, and I just post a picture of the books that I've read that week. But I never post a picture of a book that I haven't finished because I'm like, I'm only here to say, these are the books that were good enough to finish. I don't want to mention anything. Yeah, because it's like, who wants to be doing that?
Do you want to go next?
Sure. I read something weird for me. Like not a usual choice. And I read it on my Kindle, so now I have to go. But I can go to the cover. So it was called The Curated Closet. And what happened is I was I might have made Jess go to the LA airport 2 hours early because I don't like to be late.
It's okay because I hate being late too, so I'm perfectly happy to be at the LA airport 2 hours early.
All right, so I'm
right there with you. I'll meet you there 2 hours early. Exactly the same.
I'm roaming the LA airport, and there's a book about, like, how to get dressed. And, you know, I've just been in LA, and I've just been at this conference where everybody looks fantastic, and I thought, I've been meaning to up my game with clothing, so, but I didn't want to buy that book because I know that book would just become clutter. So I decided to go on my Kindle and find something else, and I don't think I found that, but anyway, this was called The Curated Closet. It was by Anishka Rees, R-E-E-S, and it was just a really fun book. You would probably get a huge kick out of it because it's like, find your color palette, define your style in 5 words or less, write it down. I had a good time reading it, and I'm having a good time sort of trying to slightly up. I remember you and Elizabeth doing, we're going to wear clothes for a month.
Oh, we're going to wear clothes for a month.
Which mystified one of my kids. He was like, they don't usually wear clothes?
Oh my God, it just about broke us.
Well, I actually thought you had read that a long time ago because a couple weeks ago, KJ was texting us about the perils of cleaning out your closet. And she did you did an admirable job of sort of weeding out
my closet. Well, that was because of another book that I read called Soulful Simplicity. Sometimes
I'm sensing
a theme.
I just
like reading stuff like that, okay? This is by Courtney Carver. And I think I might have mentioned it before, and she did this thing where she wore 30 pieces of clothes for 30 days, and I didn't cut my wardrobe down to 30 pieces of clothes, although I've been taking a picture of what I wear every day because of the Anishka Rees book, and it's occurring to me that I suspect I might only be wearing 30 things.
Well, that happens when I pack to go anywhere, because I'm a ninja packer because I travel so much. I have learned that there are certain things, and I mentioned this to you the other day, that I'm no longer purchasing clothes for the person I wish I was. I'm buying clothes for the person I actually am. And sometimes I take clothes with me for the person I think I might be when I go to that place. And then I never wear them and I've wasted room in my suitcase. But what I have found is if I take it with me and I don't wear it, unless it's something I absolutely love, I try to donate it while I'm in the place.
That's smart.
Well, and actually, I went to a hotel in Miami once for a couple of days, and they actually had in the room, I think it was one hotel, and they had in the room a box for donations saying, if you donate, I think it was like something you'd get back. I can't remember what it was. But if you donate some clothes that maybe you brought with you and you don't think you're going to wear, then we'll donate them for you. And here's the box right here in the room.
That's kind of smart.
Amazing.
In Florida, because I'll bet a lot of people sort of go down with shorts and stuff and get there and realize that they don't fit.
Right,
anymore.
Exactly. That's what happens
like
to us.
We could do a whole podcast on what writers wear.
I'm writing a little book that's coming out in March that's called Outer Order, Inner Calm, and it's all about this because I think it is just, it's very energizing even to read about clearing clutter, let alone do it. And you get fired up to do it when you read about it. So, so I wrote a book like that, partly to get myself to clear clutter, because it's so fun to think about it. Yeah, absolutely.
Sometime we need to have a debate about children's rooms and whether you should make them neaten them up or not, because I have very serious feelings. I have very strong feelings about that. So in terms of reading, you listeners out there, if you like Seabiscuit and Secretariat, there was a book that Audible gave away for free on the day of the Kentucky Derby called American Pharoah by Joe Drape. And it was lovely. It was really, really good. It was all about, you know, where this horse came from and the Triple Crown and the relevance of the Triple Crown. And I could care less about horse racing, and I loved it. And then I have to mention, actually, really quickly, I reread a book. Have you read, Gretchen, have you read I'll Give You the Sun by Jandy Nelson?
I'm trying to remember. I know I have it. Have I read it? I don't think I have
read
it.
If you have not read it, you really should. I've talked about it before. I had to write a last-minute book review for a magazine with my niece, and this is a book I had given her, and she revealed to me, she said, I would love to write a book review about that book because I think I've read it 15 times, and I've read it two or three times, and I've listened to it, and it's constantly off the shelf at at the rehab where I teach. The kids love it, and it's just a book I absolutely adore, and I think you'd like it because it's about relationships between close siblings, and they happen to be twins in the book, but
this is the one where it shifts perspective.
Right.
back and forth.
Right.
Yes, I have read that one. Okay. Yes. Excellent. I was thinking it had a different title. But I read a whole bunch of books right close together one time, and now I cannot remember which title goes with which book. It makes me crazy.
I love the way that book flows. I love the narrative and perspectives and all that kind of thing. It's just fantastic. KJ, Missy Miss, is there anything else you would like to ask Gretchen before we sign off and let her get back to her day? Because I'm sure, you know, she's got all those books to write.
Yes, she does. Well, it's always fun to talk to Gretchen because talking to Gretchen is an excuse to talk about yourself, which is the brilliant secret behind the four tendencies. But I think we've covered it. And if you have more questions about the four tendencies or just want to hear more about them, you should definitely listen to Gretchen's podcast,
Absolutely. Happier.
And of course, you can find the book and all of Gretchen's other books at GretchenRubin.com. Anything else I should mention where people can find you, Gretchen?
And then I'm on social media everywhere as Gretchen Rubin, and I love to connect with listeners and readers. So, feel free to get in touch.
Actually, writers out there listening, if you would like to know how to be a very good tweeter as a writer, you should go and look at Gretchen Rubin's feed.
Aww.
Because she is a very good tweeter. She knows the power of the quote, the power of the quote card, the power of asking questions of people. Because, man, when you ask questions of people, you get a lot of responses. It's just amazing to look at the threads that come down from some of your daily, the questions you tend to ask. It's really fun. Your Twitter feed is fantastic.
It's almost like she's a questioner.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Well, I think we're signing off.
We're signing off.
I leave that to you.
Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. This episode of Hashtag #AmWriting with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work. Pause. Stop. Thank you.